Ours will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we are going to have another interview with Jerry Branum, where we continue our review of 1981. Today, we're going to be talking about 1981 in review. As you know, at the end of each year, we go back 50 years, 40 years, and 30 years on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and we talk about the major events that happened in the bodybuilding world 30 years ago, 40 years ago, and 50 years ago. So in our last two podcasts, Jerry Branum and I have covered the 1971 year in review, and we talked about all the big events that happened in that year 50 years ago. So today we're going back 40 years, and we're going to talk about 1981. And we're going to talk about all the significant events that happened in the world of bodybuilding as far as the competitions go in our review today about 1981. So this is going to be a two-part review because there was so much stuff to cover. So today we're going to talk about the 1981 AAU Mr. America contest, which was won by Tim Belknap. And I was very familiar with Tim Belknap because I saw him compete in Illinois, where I'm from. And Tim won the Mr. Illinois contest in 1980, and then he won the Mr. Midwest contest in 1981, the year that he won the Mr. America. So I was aware of Tim before the rest of the country was, and he pretty much took the world by storm, and he won the Mr. America contest that year. So we're going to talk about that. Then we're also going to talk about the IFBB Mr. Universe contest, which was held in Egypt, a very big event. And Lance Dreyer, also from the Illinois area, won the heavyweight class, and Tim Belknap was also in that. So we'll talk about that event as well. And then we'll talk about the NABBA Mr. Universe, which was won by John Brown that year, and also the pro division of the NABBA Universe, which was won by Robbie Robinson. And then finally, we'll finish off talking about the Grand Prix events. By 1981, pro bodybuilding had really started to take off. This was the first time that it had really gained some foothold, and they started having many different events, and they had a bunch of contests called the Grand Prix competitions, which would take place in the spring of each year, and it would conclude with the Night of the Champions contest. So they started this in 1980, really, and then in 1981 they were doing it again. So Chris Dickerson was the big winner both years, so we will talk about that as well. When we finish our interview with Jerry, part one of our interview with Jerry, I'm going to go and read a few articles about some of the competitions that we're going to be talking about today. The first one comes from the October 1981 issue of Muscle and Fitness magazine, and we're going to talk about two of the Grand Prix events that we're going to be talking about in our interview. The first one was in the New England Grand Prix, where Albert Beckles surprisingly beat Chris Dickerson, who was the favorite, and then we'll talk about the 1981 Night of the Champions contest, which also came down to Albert and Chris, but then Chris was able to defeat Albert. And I think I'm also going to read another one. So I'll give you guys three articles this time. And the other one is about Boyer Coe winning the Grand Prix event that took place at the end of 1981. This was after the Mr. Olympia, which Boyer Coe, Mike Mentzer, and Frank Zane all boycotted because they felt that they were upset about the Mr. Olympia the year before in 1980 in Sydney, Australia, when Arnold won. And they figured that Franco was going to win the contest no matter who went in it. And they were right. So Boyer, Mike, and Frank Zane, and also Albert Beckles as well, all stayed out of the 1981 Mr. Olympia contest. But after that contest, they had a series of Grand Prix events that took place in Europe. And Boyer Coe won all of them, and he was in spectacular shape. He was in amazing condition. I think this might be the best Boyer ever looked, even better than the 1980 Mr. Olympia. So I will read that article also. This comes from Muscle Training Illustrated, let's see, April 1982. So like I said, that was the end of 1981. So I'll read all three of these articles when we get done with our interview with Jerry Branum. All right. So what else is going on with you guys? We are now in our second week of January. 2022. I hope you guys are having a good year. Hope everything's going good. I know this Omicron coronavirus thing is still going on and a lot of people are getting sick. I know a lot of people that I know are getting sick with the coronavirus. So be careful out there. Try not to catch it. It's getting crazy. And I know a lot of gyms are closing down again. A lot of restaurants are closing down. So it's nuts. I don't know when this thing will ever end. But I am staying very, very busy with my new job at Pro Physique. So if you guys want some online coaching from me, training or nutrition, just go to prophysique.com and you can request me as a coach. But I am really building up my clients. I'm really happy with this new job. It's really fun. And I'm doing something I love to do. So, and they also got a transformation challenge coming up in about another week. So if anybody's interested in entering that, you don't have to use a coach from Pro Physique. You can do it on your own, or you can use a coach, or you can use your own coach, or whatever you want to do. But I think it's $49.99 to enter the transformation challenge. So just go to prophysique.com and you can check that out. Speaking of this Omicron and coronavirus, I heard Pat Neave is very sick with coronavirus. I know Pat's probably in his 70s now, and I heard he lost a lot of weight. So we want to wish Pat our best wishes, and I hope he gets over this soon and doesn't get any sicker than he already is. All right. And we did get some emails. So thank you guys for sending emails. I've been waiting for some emails and you guys came through. So I want to read these emails before we get to our interview with Jerry Branum, where we talk about the year 1981. This first one actually came on my YouTube channel. I usually don't read the comments on my YouTube channel, but this one I thought was very well done. And it was about the Chris Dickerson interview that I did. Man, it had to be like 5 years ago, I think, right? 2017, something like that, with Chris. And I'm glad I got a chance to do a video interview with Chris. It's on YouTube. And also, if you just go to my Bodybuilding Legends show website, you can find it there. Or just go to my YouTube channel, which is under my name, John Hansen, and you can see it there. I've got all my interviews, all my video interviews up on YouTube. So anyways, he said, John, after December 23rd, when Chris Dickerson passed away, I reviewed the interview with Chris's friends that you aired in August. I first saw it as soon as it aired and twice after Chris died. Today, I'm about this wonderful interview you did with him in 2015. It was 2015 I did it. Where was Chris? At his house? Yes, this was at Chris's house. I see the trophies behind him. It moves me very much now to hear his voice, so very beautiful, among other things. He was a very elegant gentleman from the South, from Alabama. Only you, who are the greatest connoisseur of the golden age of our sport, could have done such a beautiful interview. I've always admired this champion. He won a lot, but he deserved another two Mr. Olympias that were stolen from him when they gave first to Arnold and then to Franco, undeserving and out of shape. Among the various comments, I read that many have had the good fortune to know him or meet him at the gym. Who knows, what a thrill. Talk to such a helpful and kind person. Other comments, few to tell the truth, I did not like. Judging him undeserving because he had a torn pectoral or deficient biceps is nonsense. Chris recovered both from the torn pectoral and the damage to the long head of his left bicep in a great way. There were other champions with obvious deficiencies, Arnold's thighs, Coe's abs, Nubre's legs. One of the most terrible things, in my opinion, that he had to endure was homophobia, pretending nothing happened. He openly declared his homosexuality after retiring from competitions. With Weider, it wouldn't have been easy otherwise. He ruined Bob Parris's career when he declared homosexuality of him in the mid-80s. Obviously, in the environment, someone knew about Chris, and it seems that even the organizer of Sydney's Mr. Olympia made some very negative comments on Dickerson's sexuality. A real shame that such people exist, that race had to win Chris. Rest in peace, Chris. You were a wonderful person. And that was written by David. So thank you for that comment. I also want to thank Danny Roy, who is one of our new Patreon sponsors. So thank you, Danny. I thanked him very much for being a Patreon sponsor and sponsoring the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And Danny wrote me back and he said, hey, John, it's my absolute pleasure. I love the 1971 year in review shows. You and Jerry have great chemistry. I always look forward to when he's a guest. His information, knowledge, and stories are so valuable. Keep them coming. I got an email from Steve Slater, and Steve said, I really appreciate your podcast. You and your guests put out so much awesome content. Thank you for what you do with all your efforts to highlight the past champions. Also, I purchased your book, on your MP6 workout, and it's very useful. It will definitely help me continue my gains at 54 years old. Keep up all the great work. It's very motivating. All right. Thank you, Steve. And finally, I got a email here from Mike, and Mike says, "Hey, John, happy new year. Thank you for the review of 1971 with Jerry. Both parts were very interesting. Between the two of you, the stories that come out of the conversation and the memories they invoke are always a pleasure to listen to. Jerry is always a hit. I know you have some great plans for this year with the guests, so I'm looking forward to it. Finally, you've inspired me to follow your example to get leaner and to maintain it. I feel renewed focus against this goal and the date I set myself. Take care, John." All right. Good luck on that, Mike. Starting off the new year, getting in shape. I love it. All right, guys. So that is all the emails I got. I think that's all I've got to say. So without any further ado, let's get to this interview with Jerry Branum, who was a former writer for Muscle and Fitness magazine, and he was also a writer for Iron Man magazine. And Jerry goes way back in the sport, back to the 1960s. So he's got a lot of great stories, and he knew a lot of these champions in his role as a writer for Muscle and Fitness. So here is part one of our interview where me and Jerry review the year 1981 in bodybuilding. Here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and I have my good friend Jerry Branum here with me today again. We are continuing our review of the year end. We go back 50 years, 40 years, and 30 years. So last time we talked about 1971, we went back 50 years. So this year we're going back 40 years, and we're going to talk about 1981. And Jerry, one thing I noticed looking over all the contests in 81 was the diversity among all the bodybuilding organizations. We still had the AAU back then. We had NABBA was still going. Mm-hmm. WABA started with Serge Noubre. So I want to talk about that because that was when Sergio made his comeback. Yeah. And then, of course, we got the IFBB. So bodybuilding back then was really a lot of different organizations. It wasn't like it is today.
Yeah, but you know what? The IFBB, if you think back, they wanted to have a hegemony on bodybuilding contests. So they made this ad hoc law where if you compete in another organization, you lost your IFBB. You couldn't compete in an IFBB show.
Yeah.
About it, that is actually illegal because that's a monopoly.
Yeah.
You know, and what makes it even worse is that the IFBB normally, you know, if you were an employee and being paid, they might be able to get away with it because you're being paid. None of these guys are being paid by that. The IFBB was trying to control their lives without offering them absolutely anything other than the ability to
compete. The right to compete, yeah.
My point being that corruption in bodybuilding goes way back. It still exists today.
Right.
Way back. A lot of corruption in bodybuilding.
Right.
And believe me, I am not being paranoid. A lot of people that say this, they're accused of being paranoid. I'm not being paranoid. I was there.
Yeah.
A lot of bad stuff going on behind the scenes.
Well, let's start off with the amateur event. I want to talk about the AAU Mr. America. Now, I think the MPC and the AAU kind of split up the next year in 1982. That was the beginning of the MPC was 1982.
Was that when Haney won in 82?
That's when Haney won, yeah.
Okay.
So 81 was really the last year where I think they were what they were trying to do then was it was kind of a combination of AAU and IFBB athletes.
Right.
And they were all going in the same show. So I remember it was a really huge event. I think Gold's Gym was the promoter of it.
Ken Sprague? Was that Ken Sprague?
No, I think Gold's Gym itself, because when I interviewed Ed Connors and Tim Kimber, they said they put that show on.
Oh, okay. So it was Bath Against Spray. Okay.
Yeah. And it was in Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, and it was a really big event. So the winner of the show, I have a little bit of knowledge about him because his name is Tim Belknap, and came from Rockford, Illinois.
Yeah. I could tell you some interesting things about Tim. I knew Tim pretty well.
Did you? Okay.
Yeah. Tim was, as you know, I'm sure you'll show photos of, was a fantastic body. He was a short guy, but very thick, thick muscles, right? He had a brother who trained too, whose name I can't remember.
Fred, I think.
Fred, yeah, yeah. But I got to know Tim well in an interesting way because Tim Belknap, first of all, he was a type 1 diabetic.
Right.
He had to take, he was actually probably the first bodybuilder that I know of who took insulin, but he didn't take it for bodybuilding reasons. He took it to stay alive.
Right.
So, and in retrospect, it makes you wonder, did the insulin use of Tim Belknap contribute to that really thick look that he had?
Yeah.
He had a, I mean, he had a very, very thick, I mean, had big legs, everything, you know. But here's the funny story about Tim Belknap. Tim Belknap, now, I don't know whether it was drugs he was using or the diet, but he was tended to be very abrasive to people.
Yeah.
Nobody liked the guy.
Right.
I hung out with him. I think it might have been that. Maybe it was that contest. I remember being in the hotel room where he was cursing at his girlfriend to the point where she was crying. And I took her aside, tried to make her feel better. You know, not any sexually, you know, just tried to say, you know, don't take it personal. You know, Tim's all keyed up for the contest. He doesn't mean
this was like in the hotel lobby?
In his hotel room.
Oh, okay.
And I was trying to, like, you know, calm it down. I said, don't take it. You know, Tim, you know, guys, when they're getting ready to compete, they're all adrenaline's running, and they tend to get – some guys get a little more tense than others, so don't take it personal. And when I went through the I walked with him through the lobby of the hotel, you know, a couple of times, and people would come up to me. It's kind of funny. They'd say, are you friendly with that guy? I said, yeah, Tim's a friend of mine. He's a great guy. Are you kidding? This guy was so hated. He reminds me of Ted Cruz today. And nobody likes Ted Cruz. That's the way Belknap was in bodybuilding. Nobody seemed to like the guy.
Right.
I never had any I heard him say people would come up to me, come up to him when he's walking. Hey, Tim. And he'd go, fuck off. And I used to wonder why did he say that to the guy? But he was kind of I don't know why, I can't explain why, but I got along with just about everybody, even the guys that nobody liked.
Yeah,
like Vince Caron, there's another guy that a lot of people didn't like.
Right.
I got along. He was like my uncle. I got along with him great. All these people that people didn't like, I seemed to get along with. I don't know why.
You're easy going.
I can't explain. All I could say is I guess it's because they acted nice to me. None of them ever attacked me. I guess that's the only thing I could think of, you know?
Yeah.
But he was as far as a bodybuilder goes, he had a tremendous physique, and he's one of those guys that actually looked much better in person than he does in any photo.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sure you'll show photos of where you'll see he has the deep abs and he has those real thick delts and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Great arm shape, you know, full bicep.
Yeah.
But see him in person, he was like rock hard. I mean, he was in great, great shape.
Yeah.
So he did, my point being, he deserved his wins. I mean, whether you like him or not, the guy was a deserving winner of everything he won.
Right.
About it, yeah. And I'll tell you another quick story about Tim before I forget. Years later, long after he retired, this is at Gold's Gym. This is years after, maybe 10, 15 years later, something like that. He comes into the gym, you know, and he's now much calmer. He's no longer competing, and it's much smaller. But we're talking, and he says, we were talking about, you know, the current bodybuilders. And I mentioned that some of the guys are using insulin. This is the early 90s. This is when insulin started getting into bodybuilding. And I'll never forget Tim Belknap goes, what? Tim, a lot of the guys are using insulin because they think it's anabolic. You know, it makes the muscles thicker and this and that. He says, you got to be kidding me. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, you know, Jerry, I'm a type 1 diabetic. I've been using insulin all my life, right? I said, yeah. He says, I would do anything to get off insulin.
Wow. He said,
these guys are out of their freaking minds to use insulin. To take it when they don't have diabetes, that's insane.
He
like a guest. He couldn't believe these guys would be voluntarily injecting insulin.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is coming from a diabetic.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I saw Belknap the year before that, 1980.
Yeah.
I went to the Mr. Illinois contest, which was in Rockford where he lived.
Right.
And I think I told this story on my podcast before. Me and my brother went up there and we were running late because from where I lived to Rockford, it was probably a 3-hour drive or something. It was really far because Rockford's way, way north of Chicago.
Right.
So, we walk in and the short class is on stage. He's the only one in the short class. So, yeah, he's the only one. He was the only.
There's no other competitors?
No, not in the short class. So he's standing there, and I couldn't believe my eyes. The guy looked like Mr. Olympia. He was incredible. And the crowd was like a church. They were shocked. Like, everybody just, their jaws were open. And they made him go through. Go ahead.
It wasn't one of those things like where maybe the other guys looked and belted up and didn't want to compete.
No, because I think it was a shock because he had won the junior Mr. Illinois in April. And this contest was in November. But in that contest, he was real big and he still won, but he was kind of smooth.
Okay.
So I guess now going way back, he used to compete as a teenager, and I knew a guy named Glenn Kinnear. Glenn trained at my gym.
Yeah, he won the Mr. America.
He won the Mr. America in 86, yeah. So Glenn was a real good teenager, and Glenn would always win all the shows. And Belknap would compete against him. He could never beat Glenn, never. And he was so frustrated. He was like, he would never win.
Right.
So anyways, I talked to Larry Bernstein, who was also a big AAU Mr. America. He won the short class in Mr. America in 84, the year, or the 83 when Jeff King won.
Right.
I think he went on and won Mr. Universe in Napa.
Right.
So Larry was in that junior Illinois. And he said, we're all in the warm-up room warming up. And we wondered who this fat kid is. And it's warm. He had like these sweats on, but he looked fat because he was so big.
Right.
He took it off and he said, everybody in the warm-up room went, holy shit. Because you got to remember, Jerry, this is 1980. There were nobody looked like that back then. Nowadays, there's a lot of guys who look like him.
That's true.
But back then, no one had that kind of freaky size. I mean, so we go to the Mr. Illinois and now he's ripped. But he's got the same size, but he's ripped.
Right.
And he was unbelievable. So I'll never forget, I was at the night show, and a lot of people wouldn't go to the pre-judging. They would just come to the night show. This guy named Ron Hagen, who was Sergio Oliva's training partner at the time, he was a big guy, competed also.
Yeah.
But he had a big mouth, you know, and he's sitting right behind me with his friends. And everybody that came out, you know, they had teenage and junior and then the mister. Everybody that came out, he was putting them down. Look at this guy. He's got no arms. Are you kidding me? Oh, my God. Look at this guy. No legs at all. Jesus, where's this guy's cap? Everybody wouldn't stop.
Right.
So then they have the intermission. He goes out into the lobby, and he sees Belknap. Belknap's just sitting on a table. And he goes, oh, hey, Tim. He goes, are you in the show? And Belknap goes, I am Mr. Illinois.
This was before the contest.
This was before the night show, yeah.
Yeah.
So the guy, Ron Hagen, comes back, and he's telling his buddies. He goes, hey, guys, guess who I just saw in the lobby? He goes, remember that kid that won the Junior Illinois, that Belknap kid? He goes, I just saw him in the lobby, and he tells a story about it. He goes, I am Mr. Illinois. He goes, what an asshole. You can't be that cocky. So I'm like 17 years old, and I turn around in my seat, and I go, hey, I saw the prejudging. I go, he's going to win. He didn't say that. He just ignored me like I wasn't even there.
Right.
So then Belknap comes out, and this guy didn't say a word the rest of the night. He was – so then, you know, this is before the internet and everything, and the word gets out throughout Chicagoland. This guy's unbelievable. So he goes in the Mr. Midwest contest in March. This is like 3-4 months later.
Right.
And it's in Rockford again. Yeah. By this time, the crowd shows up. Everybody wants to see this freak. Everybody's heard about him.
Yeah.
So he's got this crazy hair, right? The afro hair.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Curly hair.
Yeah.
So he comes out, and remember when they used to have the podium that we posed on?
Yeah.
They would just pose on the stage. They would jump. They would get on that podium.
That's right. Yeah.
He gets like 3 feet away from the podium, and he jumps on it like a gorilla. And the whole crowd goes, oh! And Sergio came to the show to watch him because everybody heard about this.
Yeah.
And Sergio was like, I got to see this kid. Everybody's talking about him. And so after the show, Sergio said, yeah, he's better than most of the professionals. I mean, that's how – so I think he was like 216 pounds at 5'4".
Wow. Yeah. All muscle. No fat.
Yeah. Now you'd think Franco won the Olympia that year, probably at 5'4", 185 pounds. So that shows you how big this guy was. It was incredible. He had legs like Platt's.
Yeah.
I remember his arms were so big, he couldn't even do a side tricep. He had to throw his arm back, and he was barely holding on with one finger. He had like 21-inch arms, 20-inch arms. He was a freak, man. He was just unbelievable.
Just an amazing amount of muscle. And, you know, a compliment that, like that coming from Sergio Oliva,
that's
what the guy really is. I mean, you know, he was really – and he was very cocky. That's another reason people didn't like him.
Yeah.
You know, somebody would come up to him like, hey, you know, there'll be a contest coming up and a couple of guys would be mentioned as possible competitors and Belknap would say, oh, get out of here. These guys can't even stand next to me. You know, he wasn't humble.
Yeah.
And the thing is, people like you when you're humble, even if you are super great, they still like you being humble. He never had that quality at all. So he tended to instantly turn people off.
Well, I guess when he grew up, he was always picked on by everybody. He was always bullied. I read a story that even the girls used to beat him up at school, you know, because he was so skinny. And so then when he got into this, of course, now he's taken all that bullying. And there was a funny story at the Mr. Midwest contest. They would register the people that morning. You know, the contests weren't big enough where they would do it the day before. They did it that morning.
Yeah.
I was in the teenage contest. Actually, Corey Everson, that was her first show.
Corey Everson, yeah.
Yeah, in 1981, she was from Wisconsin, and she won. She won. That's when they started women's bodybuilding.
But she was probably Corey Neuer back then.
Yeah, she was Corey Neuer, right. And Jeff was in it, too. Jeff Everson was in it.
The future husband, yeah.
So I was in the teenage. I actually won my class in the teenage, and I'm sitting in the audience watching, and all the open men guys are up on stage, and they're all registering. Yeah. Now, Belknap has gotten beat by Glenn Kinnear his whole life. All these teenagers. Glenn told me this funny story. He said one time he went out to Kentucky with a couple of friends of his, and there was a contest that weekend.
Yeah.
And he was kind of dieting, and he's like, yeah, there's a show out there that weekend. I think I'll jump in and do it, you know.
Yeah.
So he goes in the show, and Belknap's there. And he's not even in – Tim or Glenn's not even in shape. And he's like off season. And he gets fourth, Belknap gets fifth.
Like, oh, my God, geez.
Yeah, like Belknap could never beat him, you know. So now Belknap knows, you know, that he's going to win the show. There's no doubt about it. They're in the Midwest. So Glenn is in the show, and he's coming off of a back injury. He's not in his best shape. This is like his first contest back. And so Tim is standing on the stage, and in front of everybody goes, hey, Glenn. And Glenn's like, nah, listen, and then finally he hears him, and he goes, comes over, and he goes, hey, man, good luck. Because he knew he was going to wipe him out, you know?
Yeah. That's funny.
Wow. So now there's another funny story, another backstory with this is Tim was doing training. He was a trainer at Chicago Health Club.
Right.
And Lance Dreher was also a trainer. Lance was actually the manager at the Chicago Health Club. Now, Lance used to live in the southwest suburbs where I'm from, but he got promoted to Rockford, and they gave him a manager job there.
Right.
So Lance, I think, was married at the time, and him and his wife were going out to lunch one day, and Tim came along with them. So Tim said, he goes, you know, Lance, he goes, man, he goes, I'd love to win that Mr. America title one day. And Lance looks at him, he goes, lots of luck, buddy. And just like totally pushed the foot down. Now, it turns out this 1981 Mr. America, it comes down to Lance Dreher and Tim Belknap. So Lance was like Chicago's hope to win Mr. America for years. Everybody's like, this guy's going to be the next Arnold. He's good looking. He's blonde hair. He's got huge arms. He's got Larry Scott arm. You know, he had like 22-inch arms, incredible arms.
Yeah.
And he took third the year before. So he comes back in 1981. And Lance wins the heavyweight class. And Tim, we all thought was going to be a heavyweight, diets down to light heavyweight. He must have lost 30 pounds.
Right.
I mean, I think it was 187 or something at the show.
Right, yeah.
So, but he was still, he had that thickness and that size.
Right.
And he still wins. And then Tim beats Lance 4-3 vote.
Wow.
So a lot of drama at that show.
Yeah, yeah.
And Tim beat out Rory Liedemeyer in the light heavyweight class.
Wow. Rory's often referred to as an uncrowned Mr. America.
But Rory, I think, was underweight also because he went down to light heavyweight. He was a heavyweight. I mean, he was tall, right?
Yeah, yeah. He had a nice symmetrical physique, Rory. You know,
yeah, yeah.
A small waist, good abs, very good build.
Yeah. So you've got the short tank look of Tim Belknap against the tall aesthetic look of Rory Liedemeyer.
That's what he came to. And Lance had a kind of tank look himself.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Very thick, but kind of squarish. You know, he didn't have that aesthetic.
Right.
He had, as you said, tremendous body parts, huge back, giant, gigantic arms, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big legs, if I remember too. He had pretty big legs too.
Yeah, and a huge back. He had a huge left.
Very big back, yeah. Yes. I remember seeing him in a double bicep, back shot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huge. I mean, very wide, thick, very big.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'll go over some of the guys that were in the show. Robert Reese, who was from Wisconsin, he took second in the heavyweight class. Mm-hmm. Donald Asmus was third. Robert Coburn was fourth. Jerry McCall was fifth. Marlon Darton, who was a big, big black guy. I remember him. He was sixth.
I remember him, yeah.
Jeff Everson was eighth.
Jeff Everson, yeah.
And Mike Quinn, who won the Teenage Mr. America that year, was 10th. At 19 years old, he took 10th in the heavyweight class.
That's pretty good for
Mr. America. Yeah, that's real good, yeah.
Yeah, you know. Wow.
And then the light heavies, Belknap won, Rory Lidomar was second, Billy Arlen was third, Bronson Austin, who we talked about before, he was fourth.
Billy Arlen was from Texas, I remember correctly.
Right. And Charles Glass was fifth.
Charles Glass, yeah. Today, yeah. A renowned trainer.
Right.
Yeah.
And then in the middleweight class, because now they switch from height classes, I think, Jerry. This might have been the first year they did it.
Yeah.
And they went to weight classes. So they had a lightweight, a middleweight, a light heavy, and a heavy. A guy named James Youngblood won the middleweights. Uh-huh. And then Ken Passarello won the lightweights.
Ken Passarello, yeah.
And you know Ken Passarello, yeah.
I think I told you the story about him, right?
Ken Passarello. Yeah, yeah.
That's the guy who, he was one of the rare.
He was obese, right?
Yeah, most bodybuilders, as we've said many times, you'll find most champion bodybuilders start out on the thin side, but they call ectomorph.
Yeah.
They tend to start out thin and build up.
Right.
Very rare that you get a really fat, obese guy who trims down and it's cut enough to be a champion bodybuilder. Very rare. And Bruce Randall, goes way back. He was a 1959 Mr. Universe. But he started out lean, but purposely gained weight over 2 years, went up to 405 pounds, and then trimmed down to 187 and gained slowly back to 225 and won the universe, right?
Yeah.
That was different because he started out lean and gained a lot of weight, right?
Right.
Sorello started out as a big, fat, obese guy who just, you know, went into bodybuilding, dieted, trained. And not only did he get lean, but I think I told you, I think it might have been the 80 Mr. America. I'm not sure which year it was, but somebody did this kind of body fat testing at the contest. And he, of all the competitors, is that all right?
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. I was on my computer.
He turned out to have the lowest body fat of any competitor. That's really interesting. A formerly obese guy. Had the lowest body fat of any of the bodybuilders in the contest.
That's wow.
He might have written a book or something about how he did that, how he went from I don't remember.
He should have.
Yeah, he definitely should have, because I mean that was one guy who wow. I mean I can't think of not even five guys that have done that in all the years of bodybuilding.
He must have been pretty short, huh, Jerry, to be a lightweight.
He was a short guy. He was short. But I just once saw a before photo. He was one of those immensely fat guys that you look at and say, this guy could never get cut. Never, never. And he did it.
Wow.
Which goes to prove, I guess, if you have the willpower and you have the motivation, amazing things can be done if you really want to do it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think the AAU and the IFBB were kind of working together, and they must have had a split after this year because that's when the MPC started their own thing. They created the MPC. Yeah. But until that time, I think what was happening was the guys who were in the AAU Mr. America would go over to the IFBB Mr. Universe. So they were kind of combining them together because you remember in years past, the AAU Mr. America competitors would all go to the NABA Universe.
That's right. That's right.
But now they were doing it differently, and they were combined with the IFBB.
As a matter of fact, for years, any guy who won the AAU Mr. America automatically got a ticket and an entry into the NAB. You know, it was automatic. Right. You know, every guy. I mean, it was up to the bodybuilder whether he didn't have to compete in the universe, but the option was open to him. And then they discontinued that after a while.
Yeah.
You know.
So I got the results of this Mr. Universe, which was in Egypt.
Yeah.
Because I remember they took some, Lance Strayer took some iconic pictures of him posing in front of the pyramids, which was really cool.
I think I saw those. Yeah.
So in the lightweight class, Ken Passarello won the lightweight class at the Mr. Universe, so he got his pro card there. James Youngblood, who was the USA guy for the middleweight class, he actually got second to Gerard Benoit, who was from France.
I remember Gerard Benoit. I met him. He was a fireman in France, if I remember correctly.
Oh, really? No kidding.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Firefighter, yeah.
I remember he did the Olympia a couple times.
Yeah, he had one of those like classic European physiques, what they used to call it. Like surgery, really deep, very deep abs.
Yeah, he was always ripped.
Yeah, very lean, he had that was the kind of European, they called that the European look.
Yeah.
He was a classic example, a nice guy. I remember talking to him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So James Youngblood, I don't think ever got his pro card because back then you had to come back to the America to try to win again.
I see. Yeah.
Now in the light heavyweight class, this was a big upset, I thought. Tim Belknap got second to Jacques Nouville from France.
Another French guy. I don't know if I ever met him, but I could picture in my mind what he looked like. Again, classic European physique, great abs, good lines, and excellent symmetry. Not big, though.
No.
Tim probably overpowered him.
Dwarfed him, yeah.
I mean, so obviously they were looking for the symmetry and cuts at that contest rather than size.
Yeah, I guess with the international judges, you never know what you're going to get, right?
Yeah, I mean, the European judges would vote for the European physique.
Yeah.
They don't care about it. They look at Tim as, he's big, but he's blocky.
Yeah.
We want aesthetics. We want the V shape. We want the shoulders and the tiny waist with the ass. So they would vote. They would vote for a guy like, Nouville over Bell. I could see that.
Yeah. I remember back in Chicago when we heard that result, we were all like, are you kidding me? That little skinny French guy beat Tim Belknap? We were all shocked. We couldn't believe it.
That's what happens. I mean, a lot of the judges, it's been a problem in bodybuilding for years where, especially if the judges were former bodybuilders. I mean, people always say that at bodybuilding contests, all the judges should be former bodybuilders. You might have heard this. Because they know what to look for, supposedly. They know how to judge a physique. You know what I mean? You can't have guys that never trained or never competed. It somehow doesn't seem correct. You know what I mean? But the problem with that is that the former bodybuilders will always be, they're not entirely objective. In other words, they will always tend to vote, even if it's subconsciously, for the guy who kind of resembles them.
Right.
In other words, if Frank Zane was judging a show,
vote
for the guy that looks most like Frank Zane.
Right.
Not Arnold. Exactly. You know what I'm saying? That's the problem with former bodybuilders.
Right.
So the only way around that is, you can have bodybuilders on the judging panel, but you have to have maybe one or two guys that are not former bodybuilders to balance it out because they're not looking for any particular physique. And if they're fair, they'll judge by the standards I always talk about, symmetry, proportion, and muscle size, all of them together. You have them all together to win. And that's, to me, is a winning physique.
That's a hard decision when you got two guys like this who are totally different physiques. And the same thing with Belknap and Roy Liedemeyer. You got two guys who are totally, they might both be in great shape, but they're completely opposite physiques.
Yeah. Like I say, either one of them could win. It all depends on what the physique that, the judges prefer on that particular day.
Yeah.
I mean, if that same contest where Nouville beat Belknap, if that was held in the United States, Belknap might have won.
Right.
In the United States, the preference at that time, as it is today, was for size.
Yeah.
Today, especially in the pro ranks, size is 90% of everything.
They don't even really consider symmetry.
Well, I just mentioned two words, Big Ramey. The guy, he's got a lot of good muscle, don't get me wrong, but I mean, obviously he wins because he's huge.
Just Big Ramey,
I mean, just imagine Big Ramey competing at 170 pounds, with the same muscle shape. I don't think he placed in the top 10.
Right. No, not at all.
I don't think he was 170 pounds when he was born.
Now, one interesting thing about this was, we talk about how there's so many pro cards today and stuff. But back then, the only way you could get your pro card was you had to go all the way to the Mr. Universe and win Mr. Universe, which, you know, if you think about it, that does make sense because if you're winning the Nationals, that means you're the best in the country. Right. But if you go to the Mr. Universe, you're beating all the other national winners from all around the world. So that means you're the best amateur in the world. Right. You've gone as far as you can go as an amateur. You can't go any farther than that. That's so right. If you're the best amateur in the world, then you have to go pro, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I think, my personal opinion, I think they give out pro cards too freely these days.
Yeah.
I mean, I see online, a lot of these people, they list themselves as IFBB Pro after their names.
Yeah.
Who are these guys? I admit I don't follow bodybuilding as much as I used to, but I don't know who these guys are. I don't know how they even got their pro card. I mean, they're handing them out like candy now, and I think the only reason is to collect more, you know, fees and stuff like that. I think that's the only reason to do it.
Yeah, at the NPC Nationals, they just had it a month ago, and it was the top two in each class.
Yeah.
First and second.
Yeah. And you see, the thing is, that kind of dilutes the quality.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that the pro card should be given to people that could legitimately compete as pros.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Some of these guys, I'm not saying they're not good or they're great, but they don't have it. You know, you've seen how many guys were great amateurs, but when they went into the pros, they died out. They just couldn't make it.
Yeah.
You know, I think they should be a little more discerning about, maybe standards like we were just talking about, where a guy has to win, like, let's say a major international contest, then he gets his pro card.
Yeah.
They should do it, but that's, they're just greedy. They just want the money, so they don't care, you know.
Now, what was interesting, what happened with Belknap was even though he wins the overall Mr. America, and he's the best in the country, when he goes to the universe, he gets second. So now he's got to come back to the America again.
Yeah.
Now, by the next year, what happened was they went into the NPC AAU. So, of course, he goes to the NPC because he wants to turn pro and he wants to be on the Mr. Olympia. So, he goes in this time as a heavyweight. He goes back to the size he used to be. He doesn't go down to light heavyweight anymore. And now he's up against Lee Haney and Matt Mendenhall. So even though Belknap was only there to get a spot on the Mr. Universe team, they brought him at the prejudging. He competed at the prejudging like he was in the Mr. America or the Nationals, like he was competing in the NPC Nationals. So there's pictures of Belknap up on stage with Haney and Matt Mendenhall, even though it was just for the Nationals.
Right.
And the judges gave him third place behind Mendenhall and Lee Haney. So he didn't get a chance to go to the Mr. Universe again.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
He did compete in the – was it the NABBA Universe that he got second in?
He won the NABBA Universe, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because I think what he did was I read a magazine article where he didn't know what to do after he lost that Universe in 81. And I heard that he talked to Arnold, actually.
Yeah.
And Arnold said, you should go back and win the contest. So you should, in other words, you should go back to the Nationals the next year and try to get your spot on the Universe. And that's what he did, but it didn't work. He got third place. So then I guess he petitioned for a pro card, and they gave him a pro card in 83. And remember that show they filmed with remember when they filmed Pumping Iron 2, the women?
Yeah.
And they had that contest in Caesar's Palace?
Right. Right.
Well, they had a men's division, too, a men's pro contest with it that Lee Haney actually won. And Belknap, I remember, was in that contest, and I think he was in a couple more. But the main thing was when he turned pro, he was getting, like, 10th place, 8th place. He got no respect from the judges. So it must have been they're really judging harshly his structure, you know.
Right. Yeah, like I said, he had that – he was, like kind of, like, squarish. And
yeah, he was like a fire plug. Yeah.
Very blocky, you know.
Yeah.
You put him up against guys like Haney and Mendenhall, who had all the looks and the lines and the aesthetics.
Yeah.
And guys, Belknap, and also ran as great as he was instead of the other guy. Now he's like a third tier guy. No longer a top guy. It's kind of, but that's the way it goes, you know.
So I guess what he did after he was taking 10th and stuff at these IFBB Pro shows, he just said, screw it. He went over to NABBA, and then he had some pretty good success there.
Right.
Yeah.
And where the competition is not as intense.
Yeah, and they liked his physique better over there, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So in the heavyweight class at that 81 universe, Lance Dreyer did win, and he beat out Gunnar Rospo from Norway, who's that real big guy with the huge forearms. Yeah. Remember him?
Yeah, that's the guy who got mad when I told him that he looked like Arnold.
Oh, that guy? Oh, okay.
Yeah, when I first met him, I commented, I said, you know, you kind of remind me of Arnold.
And he did kind of look like Arnold.
He says, don't tell me I look like Arnold. I said, I don't like the guy, something like that.
Oh, wow.
I said, well, I'm sorry. I was trying to compliment you. I didn't mean it as an insult.
Yeah.
So he said, oh, it's all right. You know, he let it go. He didn't get it. I was surprised at his reaction, though.
Yeah.
Most people would be, oh, you look like
Arnold. Yeah, compliment.
I was talking about his, his face looked a little like Arnold, but he was a big guy. I meant it in a complimentary way, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't know that he had a big – I never found out what he had against Arnold. I didn't ask, but he didn't like Arnold for some reason.
Hmm. Well, what's funny with him, too, is he never turned pro because the next year he went back to the universe and Lee Haney beat him the next year.
Yeah. Boy, that guy had some forearms, though. I still remember.
Oh, yeah, didn't he?
Yeah, I commented in that same conversation. I said, man, your forearms are gigantic.
Yeah.
I said, do you do a lot of forearm work? He says, no, I don't do anything.
Genetics.
It's like the calves. You know, you go up to these
guys.
What do you do?
Forearms and calves.
Yeah, nothing. I was born this way. And it makes all of us, we're trying to build calves. We feel like slamming our head into the wall.
Right.
Yeah.
But I bet that was pretty close between him and Lance because, I think Lance just had better shape.
Yeah.
Better back and, you know.
Right.
All right, let's talk about the Mr. Universe that year in the NAVA. Because now I think at this point by 81, the NAVA universe wasn't as big as it once was, you know, back in the 60s and 70s. Right.
Yeah, it's dying.
Because I think people were going more toward the IFBB by this point.
That's right.
So the overall winner in the 1981 NAVA Mr. Universe was John Brown.
John Brown.
Who didn't have much luck in the United States, but once he went over to Europe, they really loved him over there. And I think he won. Serge Dubre had his own organization going on called the WABA, which sounds like NAVA, but it's WABBA. Right. And I think John won the Mr. World contest over there. And then he went over to the NAVA universe and he won. But the guys that he beat, it's not, you know, we used to always read these names for the NAVA universe. So it was like a who's who of bodybuilding, but.
Right.
The medium class winner was Filippo Massaroni from Italy, obviously.
Yeah.
And the short class was Terry Phillips, who I believe was from England.
That's right, he was. I remember him.
But the rest, like the top five, I don't even recognize most of these names. And John Brown won the tall class.
Yeah.
Bob Esprit was second, and Christian Gamba was third. So I don't even know who those guys are.
Those guys are unfamiliar to me, too. But I know that John Brown... He had a tall guy, lean physique. He was one of the first kind of artistic posers. Into his pose. As a matter of fact, he was a mentor to Sean Ray.
Sean
got into bodybuilding.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Vince
Taylor.
Vince Taylor, credit. Yeah. First interview I did for Vince Taylor was in Europe, of all places, when I was traveling around covering the European Grand Prix contest for Weider. I ran into Vince in Germany. He was living in Germany, I saw his physique, and I said, "My God, you could be a pro! I mean, you have a tremendous physique." I remember he had calves and everything.
Yeah.
So he said, "I don't think I maybe amateur, but I can never be a pro," which is strange. It turns out I think he set a record
for more pro wins. Yeah, at the time, yeah.
But back then, he was kind of very humble. But I remember him saying that he gave a lot of credit to John Brown for helping him get started bodybuilding. I remember he said he was from Maryland somewhere, at some town in Maryland. And he said that he met John Brown, and I think he met him in Europe. I don't remember that.
Yeah, he met him in Germany, because he was living in Germany.
Right, and John Brown really helped him a lot. So John Brown really have two great bodybuilders, Sean Ray and Vince
Taylor.
I like forgetting his last name, Vince Taylor.
Yeah. You know,
maybe it's because he I'm not friends with him on Facebook. I don't know. I don't know why, but, you know.
Well, it's funny we're talking about John Brown. I was watching a football game today because it's a Sunday, and the Detroit Lions were playing the Green Bay Packers. John Brown has two sons.
That's right.
One son is in, well, actually he's got three sons, but one of his sons plays for the Detroit Lions and the other son plays for the Green Bay Packers. So they were right. playing together.
I met them at a Muscle Beach contest a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. He was two of his football sons, right?
Yeah.
And you know, John's a tall guy.
Yeah.
These guys towered over him. They were tall guys, man.
Wow. Yeah.
And John was telling me all their accomplishments in football. And I think at the time, one of them had just been accepted to play pro ball. I don't remember which one it was.
The older one, yeah.
Yeah, they were nice guys, his sons. Yeah, but they were really big. Not so much bodybuilding big, but tall. They were big.
Yeah,
you know. I mean, he was very, very proud of him. Very proud of him.
I guess John met his wife in Germany. She's German.
Oh, is that right?
And he used to do a lot of posing exhibitions and seminars over in Europe. And while he was in Germany, that's where he met his wife.
Oh, I see.
So when they had the kids were speaking multiple languages. They were speaking German and English. You know.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
Yeah. But I did an interview with John. He's a really interesting person. And he was talking about how when he coached somebody, how he motivated them and how the mental aspect was such a big deal. And yeah. I'm sure he did the same thing with his kids. I'm sure he pushed them hard. And that's
look where
it led. It's unbelievable. He's got two kids in the NFL. I guess his other kid isn't playing football for Stanford.
Yeah.
He'll probably be a pro too.
Well, he did mention in that conversation I had with him that he talked about how hard he trained. I said, well, how did you must have really done well. Did you train these guys? You know, to get into the pro ranks like that. He says, yeah. He says, I pushed them pretty hard. And they were standing right there when he said, they just nodded.
Yeah. Yeah.
He didn't say anything, you know.
Yeah. He told me this story. He was training a girl. Remember that Galaxy competition?
Yeah.
It was kind of like a bikini contest, but they had to do an obstacle course too. It was before the bikini contest started.
I think I remember that, yeah.
So he was training a girl for that, and I don't know where the contest was, but he couldn't be there. It was out of state.
Yeah.
So she calls him up in the afternoon, and she's crying, and he goes, what's wrong? And she goes, well, I was just in this one of the events, and I didn't do good enough. I'm not going to place high. I blew it. And she goes, but I can do it one more time. And he goes, what do you have to do? And she told him the number. I got to like run this far or jump this high or whatever it was. So whatever the number was, he said, okay, you're going to repeat it over and over again. Whatever. It was like a 6 feet, 6 feet, 6'2", 6'2", 6'2", repeat it. Yeah. And he did the same thing with his kids. So when his kids were playing, you know, he would have them mentally rehearse this over and over. So the night before a game, they would mentally. He goes, how many touchdowns are you going to score tomorrow? Five touchdowns. And he goes, okay, I want you to repeat it over and over. I want you to see it tonight. So it was very much mental imagery and visualization. But it really worked. Because I guess this girl did it. She went and did the event, and she got it. Whatever she was saying, she got that exact number.
It worked. It makes sense. I mean, that makes sense.
Obviously, he knows what he's talking about. If he coached all these great champions, you know, plus the Suns, you know.
Yeah. Well,
he obviously got it down.
I mean, it's a little bit off topic, but I think this is a problem today. You see in the gyms, like, you know, Gold's Gym where I go, 99% of the people are walking around with cell phones.
Yeah.
They sit and play with the cell phones.
And headphones.
And they're not concentrating at all on there's no mental imagery at all.
No, no.
Nothing. There's no mind.
In fact, they're trying to get away from the workout. That's what I think. When I see these people, it's like the workout to them must feel like boring or work.
Yeah.
Where they just, after every set, they want to get away from it and they got to go on their phone.
That's exactly true. And you could see the results. There isn't.
Yeah.
They never change. No gains at all.
No.
Month after month, no progress. Yet they still keep, I guess they figure, well, I got to go to the gym.
Yeah.
But they're not accomplishing anything.
No, no.
Nothing. I mean, there's nothing. But to each his own, what can I say? I mean, I zoom from exercise to exercise. I wouldn't even think of bringing a phone in the gym.
Yeah.
Ever. The only time I bring the phone is when I do aerobics in the back. I have a heart monitor on my phone. It kind of, you know, I wear it just, it's, it relays my heart rate to my phone. That's the only time I bring it in the gym. And that's after my weight workout. I never do.
Me too. I was going to say the same thing. After I'm done working out, if I go do cardio, then I'll put my phone and listen to podcasts or something because I want to zone out. I don't want to endure the pain of the cardio, you know.
Well, cardio is boring. You know, it's very repetitive. And it's not as progressive as weight training. In other words, you can do it in automatic mode and get benefit. In other words, you can get the fat burning, the cardiovascular effects. You don't have to be totally focused on it at all.
Right.
Unless you're some sort of athlete that's trying to increase your speed or do something, then you'd have to do it more intensely. You know, you know, that's something where you can let your mind wander, but you can't do it in the gym. But I literally, when I go to Gold's, I'm literally the only person. You know, like I said, there was a girl there the other day. I saw her get under a leg press. As soon as she sat on the leg press, she brings out the cell phone, and I did my entire thigh and hamstring workout, and she had done one set in that entire time.
I know.
But she was on the phone. I'm thinking,
yeah.
I felt like going and saying, why are you here?
I know.
Then they get mad. You get an argument. So I keep my mouth shut.
Yeah, I know.
That's what's going through my mind when I see these people. Why are they there?
Yeah. Why? Yeah. Well, like you said, they feel like they probably think I have to go to the gym.
Right. That's it. Yeah. Yeah.
But they don't want to be there and they're not focused at all.
Right. Right. Yeah. I guess it's like somebody who goes to a job that they hate,
right.
You know, but they need the paycheck. So they go.
Yeah. They go through the motions.
They absolutely hate it. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, because if you really like training or even had some tiny goal, you'd have to have that mental imagery you were talking about. John Brown was so big.
Yeah.
It really is important. It really is.
Well, on the pro universe, though, at the NAVA, there are some big names there. Robbie Robinson obviously went over from the IFBB over to NAVA. Mm-hmm. I think he only did that 1 year, and this was in 1981, and he won. He won the pro NAVA universe.
Right.
And Dave Johns was second. Roy Duvall was third. Right. Salvador Ruiz was fourth.
Spain, yeah.
And Bill Richardson was fifth.
He was from England, yeah.
Yeah. So there were some pretty – Dave Johns, of course, 1977, Mr. America was still – he always – I think he did compete in the IFBB for a while, but he also went over to NAVA.
Yeah.
Roy Duvall was always in the NAVA universe too.
I told you the funny story about Dave Johns, right, at the IFBB pro meeting. Remember I told you that one? Do you remember that?
Mm.
Do you remember when Cal Skellig was trying to form a
body? Oh, yeah. Yeah, you did tell me that story, yeah.
Well, they called a meeting. Gold's Gym at the time was on 2nd Street. They called a meeting with all the current pros to meet at the gym. At the meeting was Ben Weeder, who, of course, was the head of the IFBB. And his purpose of being there was to talk these guys out of joining Cal's union, you know.
Right.
He didn't want them to join. So all the top bodybuilders, Boyer, Cole, all of them were there. And I remember, I was standing next to Dave Johns when Ben Weeder was doing this talk and stuff. And, after the meeting, Dave Johns turned to me and he said, you know, Jerry, I just got a letter from, Ben, you know, the IFBB. I said, yeah. He says they suspended my, IFBB membership because I competed in the NAVA universe. I said, yeah. He said, well, the problem is I've never joined the IFBB.
So he never competed as an IFBB pro?
No, he never joined the IFBB, but I know he whispered this while the meeting was still on.
Okay.
Based on that, I raised my hand and I said, Mr. Weeder, talking to Ben Weeder, I said, Dave Johns just got a letter suspending him from IFBB membership, but he never joined the IFBB. How is that possible? And Ben Weeder, oh, man, he gave me a dirty look, and he gave this kind of politician's answer, meaning an answer that didn't answer. You know, never even address the question at all.
Right.
The thing that I could never understand is Boyer Cope, who is normally a great guy, you know, I was standing in between Dave Johns and Bill Grant. I was in the middle of both those guys. Boyer Cope was a couple of feet away. He raised his hand and he says, I move that future. This is right after I asked that question. Boyer Cope says, I move that future IFBB pro meetings be limited to only IFBB pros. And he looked right at me as he said it. and I'm thinking, wait, whoa, whoa, whoa. I just tried to help Dave Johns.
Yeah.
I said, why is he attacking me? I said, it doesn't make any sense. Well, the truth is about a couple of years later, I became good friends with Boyer. You know, I didn't take it personally. I just didn't understand why he would object to that. I mean, you know, I obviously Dave Johns wasn't going to say anything, so I said it for him.
Yeah.
I had nothing to lose. I wasn't an IFBB pro. You know what I mean? Ben Weeda can't. I wasn't even, let me think. I don't think I was even writing for Joe at the time.
Oh, so, really? Okay.
Yeah, Ben Weeda couldn't do anything to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
And Roy Duvall, he won the IFBB Universe in 79, and then he was in the Olympia in 80 when Arnold won. Remember, he was standing right next to Arnold.
He had great abs, very good abs.
But now he went over to NABBA in 81. So.
Yeah, yeah. Did you didn't you interview Roy Duvall?
Yeah, I did. He's a nice, interesting.
Nice guy. I missed that one. I didn't see that interview.
Yeah, I'll just send it to you.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of these Grand Prix shows now, because by this point, by the 1980s, the Grand Prix shows, the pro bodybuilding was really taken off as far as the number of contests. You know, back then, back in the old days, they only had the Mr. Olympia.
That's right.
But now they had this series of Grand Prix shows, they called them, and it was usually held in the spring.
Right.
And Wayne D'Amelio was the guy who was putting these on.
Yeah, it was Wayne's idea. That's true.
Yeah. And then it would always end with the Night of the Champions. The Night of the Champions was the last one. So sometimes I think there was like five or six of them.
That's right.
And they would end with the Night of the Champions, and then that was like – that was the big one. And then I think they had points. So every Grand Prix show had points, and then they would have the overall winner.
Right.
So in 1980, I think Chris Dickerson was the overall winner. And I remember him and Casey were in really both in great shape.
Right.
Casey won a couple, and then Chris won a couple, and then Chris won the Night of the Champions.
Right.
And so I want to go over some of these shows that were held in 81. I think 80, it seemed like the guys were a little better conditioned in 1980 for some reason.
Yeah. Huh.
So they had one in California, and Chris Dickerson won this one. Roy Callender was second, Boyer Coe third, Albert Beckles fourth, and Johnny Fuller fifth.
Right.
And I remember Roy Callender was in really good shape for some of these shows.
Right.
Then they had one in Louisiana.
That was Casey, that, right?
That was in 1980, but in 81, Casey wasn't even in it.
Oh.
Dickerson won. Beckles was second, and Roy Callender third, so almost the same guys.
Yeah.
Then they had one in Massachusetts. Boyer Coe.
I think in that show, Beckles celebrated his 82nd birthday.
Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead. Sorry. I had to get that little.
Yeah. They had one in Washington, and Dickerson won that one also.
Yeah.
Roy Callender second, Boyer Coe third.
Right.
And then I think the last one was New England, where Albert Beckles won. So Beckles beat Dickerson at that one. Dickerson was second, Boyer was third. Kind of the same lineup. And yeah, the same kind of top five in each of them.
Right.
And then at the Night of the Champions.
That'll be the 81 Night of the Champions?
Yeah. Dickerson did win that one. So Dickerson won all of them except for one. Beckles beat him in one. But right. Dickerson won all of them, and then Dickerson won the Night of the Champions. Beckles was second. Boyer Coe was third. Johnny yeah. Fuller was fourth. And Carlos Rodriguez was fifth.
Right. Carlos Rodriguez. I remember that. Yeah.
But I remember when I saw the pictures of this, I didn't go to any of those shows, but I remember I thought Chris looked better in 1980 than 81. 81, he kind of looked smaller.
Right.
He didn't look as good. Yeah. So I think overall, I think Chris's condition in 80 was better than 81, because in the 80 Olympia, he was really in great shape.
He was. Didn't he say somewhere that he felt that he was in the best shape ever at the 80 Olympia?
Yeah, the one I interviewed him, he said that, yeah.
Right, right, yeah. I remember that stuck in my mind. Imagine he was better at the 80 where he lost than at the 82 when he won.
When he won, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep.
They also had, I think it was after the Olympia, they had some more Grand Prix shows. I think these were in England, though.
Okay.
And Boyer Coe was in outstanding condition because, you know, Boyer, he boycotted the 81 Olympia.
Right,
so it was him and Mike Mentzer and Frank Zane and Albert Beckles also. They all boycotted the 81 Olympia.
Listen, what happened in 80? That was in response to the 80 Olympia. Which
right, because of what happened in 1980.
Right.
So Boyer got in a fantastic shape, and they had these Grand Prix shows in Europe. I think it was after the Mr. Olympia. And Boyer won them all.
Yeah.
And he was in outstanding shape. Because I remember seeing the pictures, and I was like, man, I wonder what – I mean, I don't think anybody would have beat Franco, no matter what you look like. But Boyer really looked – I think that was one of the best shapes he ever looked in his life.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
And he actually beat Dickerson also. Dickerson beat him a lot back then. But at the World Grand Prix, it was called the Grand Prix World Cup. I think that was the last one. Right. Boyer won that. Dickerson was second. Bronson Austin was third. Johnny Fuller was fourth, and Dennis Cinerino was fifth.
Dennis, yeah.
And Albert Beckles was sixth.
Right.
Do you remember that show, Jerry? They had like a blue background, and I think Boyer had like blue trunks on, but he was in really outstanding shape.
Was that in England?
Maybe, because the other one was in Belgium, and then they had one in Wales.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure where the World Grand Prix was.
I remember Boyer that year being in really excellent shape.
He was like bigger and hard as a rock.
Yeah. I mean, his arms were tremendous, you know, great shape.
Yeah.
And he had that double split in his bicep, you know, yeah.
Yeah, it looks like they had one in Belgium, Wales, and then the last one was the Grand Prix World Cup. So he won all of those.
Wow. That was probably his winningest year.
Yeah.
As a pro, you know.
Yeah, because he won a string of those shows.
Yeah.
All right, now before we get to the Olympia, I want to talk about this new organization that Serge Dubré started called the WABA World Championships, which I believe he started in 1980 and 81 because Serge was kicked out of the IFBB after 1975, right? Because he was – so this is interesting. He was originally the vice president of the IFBB.
Yeah.
And then Roger Walker told me this story where they had an election for the head of the IFBB. So Ben Weider was, of course, the chairman. He was the head of he was the president of the IFBB. Okay. But the one year they decided to do this election, and Serge Dubré was the vice president, and Serge ran against Ben Weider. And according to what Roger Walker told me, Serge Dubré had the votes. He was going to beat Ben Weider.
Wow.
So they saw this and they changed the votes before they announced it so that Ben Weider would still win. But Serge was the vice president. And then after 1975, I don't know what the real story was, but they said that he was making porno movies because he was an actor. And so they said, we can't have this guy as our vice president. This is, you know, bad image for the IFBB. And they kicked him out. And they suspended him, and he was never allowed to compete in the IFBB again. Right. So in 1976, he went over to NABBA, and he won the NABBA Universe pretty easily. And then in 1977, he lost to Tony Emmett. Mm-hmm. And I think he was pretty upset about that because he thought he had a better physique than Tony Emmett. Right. And then I think in 78, he lost to Bertel Fox.
Yeah.
Right. So I think after that, he got upset with both NABBA, and, of course, he couldn't go back to the IFBB. So he started his own organization called WABA, which was W-A-B-B-A. Yeah. So he had a contest, an amateur contest called the World Championships in 1981, and John Brown also won that show.
Right.
And it kind of looks like almost the same lineup as what was at the NABBA Universe. Terry Phillips won the short class. Georges Doukalis, what I never heard of, he won the medium class. And John Brown won the tall class and the overall. And it looks like mostly European competitors. I don't see anybody else from America.
Yeah.
But what I want to talk about is he had a professional WABA championship. It was called the Pro World Cup. And it was held in France, I think. Mm-hmm. And Sergio came back.
Right.
So Sergio came back the year before. Now, Sergio, after he left the IFBB, when was his last IFBB show? 73, I think, right, when he won the international.
Yeah.
And ever since 74, he had been going over to the WBBG, like Dan Lurie's organization and stuff.
That's right.
But he was always out of shape. I'm sure you've seen a lot of those pictures. And
very, very smooth, yeah.
Yeah, he'd come in fat or smooth, but they always gave it to him. He always won because he was Sergio, you know. I remember Bill Grant competed him once against him, and He beat Bill Grant. He beat Tony Pearson. He beat all those guys that he competed against.
Yeah, well, he was a legend, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not fair, but that's the way, you know.
Yeah. And he still had an amazing body. It's just he was smooth. He was out of shape.
Yeah, he always had this, even when his waist was flabby.
Yeah, small.
Still was small.
Right.
That freaky waist where
I know. I mean,
you could see that it was like fat,
but
it's still small. He never got a wide waist. You know, he still had the illusion of being somewhat in shape. I mean, this man used to drink like dozens of Coca-Colas before a
time. Right before the show.
Dieting was what dieting?
Right.
I don't know whether he. I wonder if he, I always wondered whether he died for that show in Essen, where he really looked great against Arnold.
Yeah, I wonder what he did for that show too, because that was his best ever shape.
Because he was actually really cut for that show.
Yeah, he was. Yeah,
most cut I've ever seen him.
When he won his first Olympia in '67, he was really cut for that.
Right. Yeah, and he might have done a little dieting for those shows.
Yeah.
But the rest of them, I guess he just didn't bother.
But I guess he figured without Arnold as a, he just had no motivation to train, to diet or train hard. He knew if he showed up, they were going to give it to him anyways.
Yeah, and he was right.
But in 1980, when Serge Gnabry created this organization, I remember he competed in Long Beach, California.
Yeah.
And he was up against Cal Scalak and Dave Johns.
Right.
And he looked outstanding. You remember those pictures, Jerry? He was unbelievable. I mean, he was way bigger than he was before. And he was actually in really good shape. He was pretty cut.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's when he had the bald head. That's when he shaved his head.
That's it. That's right.
Yeah. So in 1981, they have a contest. I think it was in France. It was called the Pro World Cup. Now, this is interesting because Serge Gnabry was the president of the organization. He was a promoter of the contest, and he went into the contest. He competed in the contest.
That's got to be a first. I never heard of that before.
Right. Listen to this lineup. You had Serge Gnabry, Robbie Robinson, Ahmet Anoulu from Turkey, Dave Johns, Cal Scalak, and Tony Pearson, all competing in this contest.
That's a great lineup.
That's a fantastic for a non-IFBB show. That's an unbelievable lineup.
Yeah. And who won that?
Sergio.
Sergio won, okay.
But you think Serge Gnabry would have won because...
I was just going to say, I'm surprised Serge didn't give it to himself,
Yeah, right.
I'll tell you about...
I'm surprised he didn't judge, too.
he had quite an ego, Serge Gnabry. He was great, don't get me wrong, but he wasn't shy about it. Let me put it that way.
Right.
He had pretty big ego.
So I've got the video from this contest, and Sergio is absolutely gigantic. He's huge. I mean... I look at some of the pictures from that contest today, and I'm still blown away. This is 40 years ago now.
Yeah.
And I look at these pictures, and I'm like, oh, my God, this guy was just so incredible. Yeah, his arms are so big, and his waist is so small.
Yeah.
But he was really smooth at this contest. The year before, when it was held in Long Beach, and he was against Cal Scalak, he was in, I thought, really good shape. And Cal thought he should have beat him because Cal was in better condition. But Sergio just had that body, you look at these, I'll post these pictures from this contest on Facebook and stuff, and people are like, oh, there's no way Sergio should have won. He's way too smooth, but he was, like you said, he was a legend. He was unbelievable.
That's it. He was a three-time Mr. Olympia,
And Sergio Gnabry was in fantastic condition, really cut. He looked amazing.
I don't recall Sergio Gnabry ever being out of shape in any
kind. Yeah, me neither.
Where you could say he's smooth or something like that.
Right.
I never saw that.
No, me neither.
I mean, but he was one of those guys that had some crazy training ideas,
Oh, yeah, and diet, too.
And somebody put a picture of him when he was in peak shape on Facebook the other day. So somebody wrote underneath, could somebody please give me Serge Gnabry's training routine?
Hmm.
I was going to write, buddy, you don't want to know his training routine.
Right. But,
it's not going to work for you,
Right.
I mean, he talked about doing he was one of those guys that believed in doing like thousands of reps of abs every
day,
and that kind of stuff. And I remember talking to him in Gold's Gym, and I said to him, because he had these slabby, big, nice pecs.
Huge pecs, yeah.
Serge, how did you develop those pecs? I mean, fantastic pectoral development. I see you using like 25-pound dumbbells. That didn't give you those pecs.
Right.
He told me something that Albert Beckel said also. He said years ago he lifted – used to do heavy bench presses, heavy work. He built the foundation, and after that all he did is kind of shape it and, kind of mold it. In other words, he said he didn't try and get it any bigger. He just tried to kind of perfected, more or less.
Yeah.
So that's why he never lifted heavy weight. I used to see him do this thing that Arnold copied. He would lie on his side. You know, he had not great delts too, Sergio Bray. He'd lie on his side and do a kind of a lateral, but it was kind of like going like this rather than.
I know what you're talking about, yeah.
There's pictures of Arnold got that from him.
Yeah.
Sergio Bray taught him how to do that exercise. And the interesting thing was I never saw either one of them use more than 20-pound dumbbells.
Yeah, yeah.
Never. That it was very lightweight that they did.
Right, right.
Hmm. I tried it, and I figured if they use 20, I'll try it with 15. Because, And I remember I did it. I duplicate. I didn't feel a thing. I never liked it.
Yeah.
Anything out of it at all.
Wow.
And Arnold and Serge liked it.
Yeah. I remember that exercise.
Yeah.
And then Robbie, who went over to the NABBA Universe that year, he also went into this contest. So he must have been done with the IFBB in 1981.
Yeah.
He did NABBA and WABA. He got third place. He was in really good shape. I thought he looked a little smaller, but, Robbie's just got that amazing shape. I remember his front double bicep was incredible.
Oh, yeah, a tremendous front double bicep, yeah. Now, Robbie has had problems with the IFBB over the years,
Yeah.
He's always felt that there's a racism element there, he could be right, but that's what he's felt. The famous story we talked about last time about the statue in the Weider lobby, how they, Bobby's body with Joe Weider's head. I mean, he didn't like that either. So he's always been suspicious of the IFBB.
And then Ahmet Anulu was in fourth, which was a good placing in this lineup.
Yeah.
And Dave Johns was fifth, and Cal Skalak only got six. But I remember Cal on the show, he was really big, but he was pretty smooth. Yeah. Definitely not as cut as he was the year before.
Right, right. Cal had that type of physique where he had to be really cut to be on.
Yeah.
He had your big, big, huge arms, you know what I mean?
And
huge chest, pecs, and, a little light on the legs, his physique had to be really almost ripped.
Yeah.
I mean, really hard shape to really, if he smoothed out, he just looked like a big bulky guy. I mean, he
was
impressive. I remember, I got in an argument with him at Gold's Gym. I think this was, 77. Let me see. He won the American. Was it 76 he won it?
76. And he won the Universe.
So this was 76. So I remember it was the year he won the American. He was going to enter the Cal, right? And I was training for the Cal that year. And I used to see him in the gym. He was very cocky, Cal.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I'll make you a bet. I said, you're entering the California. He says, yeah. I said, I bet I beat you. Now remember, he was bigger than me.
Yeah.
He was much bigger than me. And he was taking stuff. I was clean. I wasn't on any drugs. But the reason I said that was I looked at his legs. His legs were zero.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, zero. I mean, he had no quads. No leg, bicep, no calf. My legs were my best body part,
mm-hmm.
especially my thighs. So I said to myself, I'll beat him on the legs. Well, he improved enough to not only win the Cal, we made like a gentleman's bet. It wasn't for money.
Yeah.
But it wasn't because not only did he win the Cal, he went on and won the Mr. America.
Right.
I didn't expect. I thought this guy would never do crap in bodybuilding because his legs to me were terrible.
Yeah.
But he improved him enough to get by. He never had great legs. Of course, the irony is that after he retired from bodybuilding, he became a cycles competitor.
Yes.
Dropped down to like 150 pounds. And now he does only leg work.
Right.
But I saw him. He got second in a master cycling contest. I saw a photo of him. He they say that once you're a bodybuilder, you're always a bodybuilder.
He's flexing.
He had this lean bicycle, cyclist physique, but on the podium, they put the first, second, and third. He was second. He was flexing his arm. He still had that famous bicep, but now he was like a little tiny thing.
Right.
Huge, giant bowling ball bicep he had.
Yeah.
Now he should be down to a golf ball.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had a beard at that show too, which was weird.
Yeah. I heard that Cal, for some reason, doesn't like to talk about his bodybuilding days.
Yeah, I tried to get him on, and Sean Ray was going to help me. I think Sean Ray saw him at a funeral. Somebody died. I forget who. I think it was Dan Howard when Dan Howard died.
Yeah.
And he said, no way. He does not want to talk about it at all.
I wonder what is
it, he's like Bob Paris the same way. Like, they just don't want to talk about it at all.
What are they so bitter about it?
I don't know.
Weird. I don't get it. Huh. Well, what are you going to? Oh, Bob Paris, another guy. Jeez.
Yeah.
I see him today, but the guy had pretty broad shoulders. He's like a little narrow, skinny guy.
Oh yeah, he's very skinny. Very. He's got skinny.
No muscle on him at all.
Obviously, right? Doesn't work out at all.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Zero. I mean, Dorian Yates, for example, has lost a lot of size.
Yeah.
He's, you know, he's in his late 50s. I got to give the guy credit. He says he doesn't train. He doesn't train nearly like he used to.
Right.
He has no reason to. He's right.
Right.
He does yoga and all that stuff and Pilates, all that kind of crap. But he still looks athletic. And if you look at him without his shirt, he still has that semblance of a physique.
Yeah.
Still has some pecs. He has some delts. His arms are a lot smaller. But you could say, yeah, this guy was a bodybuilder.
Yeah.
But when you look at Bob Paris, and you say, well, this guy was a
– you would never think he was a bodybuilder.
National champion and one of the – competed in the Mr. Olympia. People would say, are you kidding?
Right.
No way.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
See? And honestly, I don't understand that. In other words, of course you can't retain the size and mass. I mean, we all know that guys use drugs. You know, a lot of it had to do with it. But, you know, they lifted heavy, whatever. But the point is, do you really need to have your muscles atrophy that much? Shouldn't you try and retain some muscle?
Yeah.
Just for health reasons?
Retain what you can, at least, yeah.
I mean, because if you look at the medical journals, there's a direct relationship between muscle mass and mortality.
Yeah.
Forget about body. The more muscle you can retain as you age, the greater your chance of living a longer life.
Yeah.
So why would you atrophy down to nothing? I don't understand the thinking of these guys.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, you know, again, you don't.
You said that about Franco, too, remember?
Yeah.
Franco hadn't trained for years.
Right. I don't understand why they give up training completely.
That's, I don't either. Especially when they're world champion bodybuilders. You know, I think they would love it.
I mean, you look at a guy like my friend Bill Grant. He's 75. Yeah. I mean, he still trains. He loves it.
He's 75, Jer?
He's 75 years old.
Wow. He still has
that bicep. He's
lean. Yeah. He's amazing.
He's smaller too, but he still looks like a bodybuilder.
Yeah, yeah. He looks fantastic.
And he enjoys training. He knows it's good for him.
Yeah.
He knows it's healthy for him. That's the sensible way. So
yeah.
I just don't understand the thinking of these guys.
Me neither.
I can't figure it out.
I mean, I've been training for 45 years. I love it. I love going to the gym.
I mean, again, you don't have to try and be big. You don't have to lift heavy weights.
Yeah.
But just train regularly for your health and maintain a certain amount, as much muscle as you can.
Right. Well,
you know, no drugs. Just do it with nutrition and exercise. You know, it doesn't take a lot.
I mean,
you go to the gym 3-4 times a week for 40 minutes. That's
right. Right.
That's nothing. Come on. You tell me you don't have time for that?
Right.
Believe that. There's been some recent presidents that I heard, like George Bush. All right. He's not my favorite president, the younger one. Did you know that he started his day every morning? They had a White House gym. He would work out for 2 hours before he went into the
office. Wow. Really?
6 days a week.
Wow. I'm kidding.
After President of the United States and Obama would engage.
Yeah. Obama did too.
If the president of the United States has time to exit,
forget about it. Right.
Trump is a different category. We're not even going to talk about him. But
yeah.
If the president of the United States has time to train, you're telling me you don't have time to? I don't believe it. I'm sorry.
Right.
I don't buy it.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you to Jerry Branum for being a guest on the show again and talking about the year 1981. We will have part two of our interview with Jerry next week, where we will talk specifically about the very controversial 1981 Mr. Olympia contest. And if you want to support Jerry's efforts, you can go to his website, which is appliedmetabolics.com, and subscribe to his newsletter if you like. Jerry puts out this huge newsletter every month for only $10 a month. So it's a really, really good deal. All right. I also want to thank our generous Patreon sponsors for sponsoring another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I've got some new news for our Patreon
sponsors as well. So as soon as that comes through, guys, I will let you guys know about it right here on the show. Should be very interesting. All right. Without any further ado, I want to read a couple articles here. This first one comes from the October 1981 issue of Muscle and Fitness. And it has Arnold on the cover where they have pictures of him as Conan. It says Conan, Arnold's latest triumph. So this was right around the time the movie Conan came out. So the first article is called the New England IFBB Grand Prix. It's written by John Bailick, who went on to be the owner of Ironman magazine. And it says Beckles wins big in New England, but loses to Chris in New York. It says in what turned out to be a stirring battle between two of bodybuilding's great veterans, 41-year-old Chris Dickerson and 46-year-old Albert Beckles, split the honors at the New England and New York Grand Prix shows May 2nd and 9th, respectively. And had it not been for a disastrous final dietary and training miscalculation, Beckles might actually have swept both contests. Dickerson established a 2-point lead over the first three rounds at the New England Grand Prix, but Beckles wiped that out in the pose down to score a comfortable 5-point victory. In the week between the two contests, Al should have continued with the routine that got him the victory in New England. Instead, he doubled his time in the gym and tightened his diet to the limit. As a result, he was badly overtrained in the Big Apple, and he lost to Dickerson at the fourth annual Night of the Champions extravaganza. The first New England Grand Prix was held Saturday, May 2nd at the Worcester, Massachusetts Municipal Auditorium. The physique productions team of Wayne D'Amelia, Charles Blake, and Karen Clark combined with their local promoter, Cliff Sawyer, to stage an exciting event. In what was a shocking result to many, unheralded Albert Beckles soundly thumped previously invincible Chris Dickerson in the pose down to make up a 2-point deficit. This was the first Grand Prix loss for Dickerson in more than a year. For Beckles, it was the first contest victory in nearly 10 years. His last IFBB victory was the 1971 IFBB Mr. Universe. More than 1,500 fans attended the show. The unbridled enthusiasm of the Worcester audience was reminiscent of those old crazies who attended the annual IFBB fall show at the Brooklyn Academy of Music during the mid-60s. Then the people screamed for Larry Scott, Harold Poole, and Dave Draper. At Worcester, the fans chanted, "Big Al, Big Al, Big Al." While Poole still strides the IFBB platforms, Albert Beckles and Chris Dickerson are the new breed of IFBB hero. 14 contestants entered the prejudging, which was witnessed by 500 wildly supportive fans. The competitors were unanimous in their praise of the fans' enthusiastic response to their efforts. Win or lose, they made it worth the effort for me, Dickerson remarked at Cliff Sawyer's post-contest bash. Clearly, it was a two-man battle from the start with both Beckles and Dickerson in superb shape. As is his habit, Boyer Coe has improved in every Grand Prix show this year, but at the New England competition, he was still not in 100% condition. He eventually finished third, but he was no threat to Beckles or Dickerson. In round one of the prejudging, the relaxed facing stances, Dickerson jumped off to a 6-point lead over Beckles. Chris garnered his customary 100 points for the round, while Al managed only 94. Clearly, this is not a strong round for the man who emigrated from Barbados to England nearly 20 years ago. Albert needs to work hard on these three poses. Beckles made up 4 points in round two, however, scoring a perfect 100 points in the 7 compulsory poses. The crowd went totally nuts when he hit his opening front double bicep shot in round two, and that started the Big Al cheering section. Dickerson got a 96 in round two. Round three, the free posing section was held during the evening performance. Beckles and Dickerson posed magnificently, and since both notched a 99-point score, Chris still had a 2-point lead going into the pose down. Clearly, the 7 possible points in the pose down would be crucial. I clearly remembered how Casey Viator had come from behind in the pose down to beat Chris at the 1980 Louisiana Grand Prix. I wondered if Dickerson was flashing back to that show too. The pose down began, and Beckles clearly had the superior tactics. Chris prefers to remain aloof from his sweating competitors and just do his own thing, but Beckles positioned himself down at the end of the line of the 5 finalists right next to Dickerson. The audience loved his aggressiveness. "Big Al, Big Al, Big Al," they chanted. Every time Dickerson would hit a pose, Beckles would duplicate it. Usually he succeeded, and more often than not, he looked superior to Chris in the pose. The crowd went berserk. "Big Al, Big Al, Big Al." and Albert took courage from their words. He devastated Dickerson. The judges then called for Jess Beckles and Dickerson to pose, but clearly the crowd had decided who the winner should be, and the judges confirmed their choice by awarding Beckles all seven first-place votes. The final score was 300 points for Beckles and 295 for a disappointed but courageous Dickerson. Coe, as mentioned, took third. Greg DeFerro was greatly improved and grabbed fourth place. Rocky seemed quite happy with his check. Johnny Fuller, with his ruggedly developed physique, rounded out the top five. Hubert Metz, in his first Grand Prix appearance, tied Samir Benoot for sixth. Carlos Rodriguez was eighth. Harold Damian Poole was ninth, and Frank Wainwright was 10th. A disappointing Ray Menser tied with Ron Magnum for 11th, and Len Archambault was 13th. Rod Koontz, who failed to appear for round three, was last. Overall, it was a fine show. Cliff Sawyer, Wayne D'Amelia, Charlie Blake, and Karen Clark should be congratulated. So should Beckles and Dickerson. Their superb mano-a-mano battle will go down etched in gold in the annals of bodybuilding history. All right, now this next article is from Roger Schwab, and it's called New York, New York. To bodybuilding fans from the 50s, the quality of physiques in IFBB competition today would look like something from outer space. Classic confrontations keep historic sporting events evergreen in the memory. Bodybuilding is abundant with awesome face-to-face meetings that, although they might have occurred years ago, spring back to the mind at the mere mention of the names. Reeves versus Peterson in 1947 gave birth to a legend. That Mr. America evening, Hercules was created. A half-point victory launched Steve Reeves on his ride along the road to glory and handed Eric Pedersen a ticket to anonymity. Dillinger versus Pearl in 1956 led the former to a Mr. Universe win and the latter to the pursuit of perfection, never to lose again. Scott versus Poole at the 1963 Mr. Universe and the 1965 and 66 Mr. Olympias introduced the first California sensation to New York via Brooklyn and set off tremors that are still shaking the bodybuilding world. These classic Scott versus Poole confrontations, West versus East, might be considered the birth of modern bodybuilding. The cheers rang louder in the rafters of the old Brooklyn Academy of Music in 1965 than ever before in the history of the sport. Coe versus Dickerson, 1969. The significance here is obvious. The confrontations of these two dedicated athletes now are entering their third decade, yet the rivalries burn hotter than they did nearly 13 years before. Schwarzenegger versus Oliva, 1969 through 1973. An entire book could be written about the meetings of the two most discussed mythical giants in the history of the sport. The physiological comparisons and the psychological contrast unleashed a storm of words that rumbled from North America to Europe. This leads us to two other names, Dickerson and Beckles. The 1981 Night of the Champions was a culmination of the previous 2 years of the Grand Prix circuit, which Chris Dickerson clearly had dominated. Now, Dickerson is considered beatable. Certainly, it is reasoned, his physique is unfinished. Small biceps and a lack of hard muscularity are visible weaknesses. Yet he wins. Why? He wins because within the context of the sport itself, Chris Dickerson is clearly the quintessential bodybuilder. Perfect preparation. Perfect presentation. This is a man who comes to an event knowing his every move on stage. Tonight in New York is no exception. Superb skin tone and just the right amount of oil, Chris's posing presentation is light years ahead of the routine of any other contestant. If Ed Corney created the state of the art, Dickerson now personifies it. The only part of Chris's physique that seems vulnerable to body fat is the abdominal area. When he's at his best, Chris is sharp or very defined at the waist. Tonight, he is not quite as sharp. He can be beaten. Albert Beckles is at an apex of a career that covers more than 20 years. He displays a hard muscularity evident even in the facial muscles. Tonight, there is more than just the most spectacular peak biceps in the world, much more. The quality of hard muscle from head to toe sets Beckles off from every other contestant. Although I gave Dickerson 320s this evening, I was a member of the judging panel, my vote in the pose down went to Beckles, whom I had scored 19.5, 20, and 20 in the first three rounds. From the onset, it was apparent that the ultimate winner of the Night of the Champions 4 would be one of these two. Dickerson's symmetry and balance of physique, his presentation, and the intangibles he possesses tonight outweigh the etched mountain of a physique presented by Beckles. He wins the contest and with it, the overall Grand Prix Championship for the second year in a row. Although there's only one man awarded first place, there were others who won too. Bowyer Coe took third. He was not at the level he achieved in Atlantic City at the World Cup, where he upset Dickerson. It's difficult for Bowyer to maintain the extreme muscularity in his torso that is always evident in his arms and legs. When he is there, well, his 307-point total in Atlantic City is proof enough of how good he can look when he's at his best. When not at his best, Coe is only a finalist. He has developed a troop of loyalists who see him as number one regardless. Johnny Fuller, who was fourth, has such a remarkable physique that he can do Oliva's frontal hands overhead pose and get away with it. With thighs that show marked cross striations when flexed, his only shortcoming is a slight imbalance between the lower and upper body. Rounding out the top five was Carlos Rodriguez. Carlos created the same effect this year as Ed Corney did last year, presenting a muscular finished physique at the pinnacle of his potential. His posing to the haunting Ghost Riders in the Sky brought out a charisma that's indigenous to Carlos. Harold Damian Poole placed sixth. He would have surprised no one if he had placed higher. A lean, muscular specimen without a trace of puffiness anywhere, Poole must have had his body fat level down to 3 or 4%. Damian Poole in 1981 presents a far more symmetrical, less knotty look than the Harold Poole that revolutionized bodybuilding back in the early 60s. If he could be bigger while maintaining the same degree of muscularity, let's just say that Mr. Poole has another chapter in his book. Hubert Metz is a lesson in physiology. The man has probably done more to reach for greatness with his limited potential than any other active professional bodybuilder. Metz was not blessed with great genes, but he can stand with anyone. He creates a powerful presence on stage, exuding confidence and willpower. Developing thickness in the upper back will be a priority for him. Greg DeFerro has adopted as his image Rocky, the underdog, and that is exactly what he will remain unless he's able to distinguish his muscularity from that of his competitors. He has all the tools. What he needs is maturity and the stage presence that comes with time. Ray Mensur and Samir Banut don't need me to tell them what they have to do. Ray was the best amateur in the United States and the world one evening in Atlanta in September 1979. Samir was the best in the world another evening in Philadelphia the same year. Frank Wainwright is coming on strong, young and confident with outstanding arms and a fine stage presence. All he requires is time and exposure to show if he has the stuff of greatness. Rod Kuntz deserves mention. Yet again, there is great potential here, but in New York, the sharpness was lacking. Rogelio Pio Montenegro and Annabelle Lopez rounded out the competition. Montenegro could be better with a more contemporary posing routine. Lopez needs much more muscularity. I'd like to point out here that the placard system used at the Grand Prix events, the judges showing their scores, while theoretically valid, is in practice intimidating to the judges. I believe that the higher scores at the evening show are indicative of this, regardless of the theory that the third round, the free posing, automatically lends itself to high scores. It should also be noted that Bowyer Coe, on behalf of the pros, publicly thanked Wayne D'Amelia, Charles Blake, and Karen Clark for their contribution to professional bodybuilding. These promoters who have worked so hard and so long certainly deserve our thanks. All right. And one more, guys. I got one more article. This one is about Bowyer Coe winning the other Grand Prix circuit that was held in Europe after the 1981 Mr. Olympia. And this comes from Muscle Training Illustrated magazine from April 1982. It was written by the photographer Denny. Said the posing of Bowyer Coe at the Grand Prix de Montreal, it was held in Montreal, Canada, on November 21st, 1981, in the St. Denis Theater, was a bit confusing to the senses of those who attended. A cross between an adventure movie and muscle mime and a cascading, exploding sinew, it later left no doubt in anyone's mind who was the winner that day. But in the words of ace photographer Russ Warner, who attended, the sentiment glibly took vocal form. Are you sure that was Coe? Bowyer's routine extrapolated broad expanses of vascularity with a mighty visual tonnage of muscularity. His choice of platform music from the film Raiders of the Lost Ark accentuated a drama of posing life, unseen until this event. which incidentally made him the overall key rater of the International IFBB Grand Prix Pro Circuit. This nosed out Chris Dickerson's national Grand Prix wins in America. The best Boyer Co. ever seen, when asked about his new ratership in a hotel elevator, later remarked, "I was very impressed by the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark. However, in this case, rather than the hero, Co. himself became the sacred Ark of the Covenant that devastated a competing army of men, which included Al Beckles from England in second place, Johnny Fuller from England in third place, Tony Pearson from the USA in fourth place, Josef Wilkosch from Germany in fifth, Andreas Colling from Sweden in sixth, Scott Wilson from the USA in seventh, plus Carlos Rodriguez, Damien Poole, Mohamed Makawi from Egypt, Wayne Robbins from Canada, Steve Davis from the USA, and Jocelyn Pelletier from Canada. The contest, promoted by the eloquent and impeccable Winston Roberts, also featured a women's Grand Prix event reported next issue in Doris Berrio's Curves and Peaks column, and it was sponsored by Jim Nay's Equipment Company, Bill Pearl's Products, with Pastificio, a famous Montreal restaurant of exquisite cuisine. Thank you, Pastificio, for a fabulous press relations dinner the night before. MTI predicted a few issues ago that Winston Roberts' promotion would be dynamite, and it was only mildly caught in an understatement of facts. Notes from the event: Coe's new charisma could have been more eroded had it not been for a staging mishap in Al Beckles' posing routine via a taped music snafu that threw his routine's timing off and into chaos. Johnny Fuller, whom photo hawk Gary Bartlett christened the Bizarro, placed his highest yet since turning pro. He literally buffets the hell out of the lineups with his chunked out vascular protrusions. Tony Pearson, like Co, a former Mr. America winner, shall now and forever be known as Tony the Good, since it was established by IFBB President Ben Weider at the pre-contest judges and competitors meeting that Pearson is the answer to a contest promoter's prayer. Tony gets A's for cooperation in the pre-event promotions, only to be matched by the cheers on the platform. Here is a former amateur in making a very adequate and promising pro. At that same meeting, driven hard by the second Mr. Olympia controversy in 2 years, Weider was very emphatic about getting rid of judges who cannot score properly, as evidenced by their separation and marginal gaps from the average. Wide individual judging margins often reveal judging instability. Next in appraisal was Josef Wilkosch, the well-packaged 81 IFBB Pro Mr. Universe from Germany. A slight bit off his peak, Josef makes an excellent addition to the pro scene. He's also embarked on a European movie career. And among them all stood the Viking, Andreas Colling, who, according to the score sheets, was tied with Scott Wilson, an extremely controversial decision. Many feel Colling's excellent stage presence and disco-posing theme style allowed him to bypass the more muscled and shapely Wilson. In the end struggle, however, one champion reigned supreme, at least psychologically and in symbolic projected stage aura. That juggernaut in the flesh was an Indiana Jones of muscle, cracked some whips, blew up some airplanes, punched out a truck, defied the massive boulder of human laziness, and gleaned the treasure, using a covenant made with himself not to lose again in 1981. And that man was Boyer Co., Raider of the Grand Prix. And Boyer did look fantastic at this contest. All right, guys, that is it. So I had three articles for you. I hope you enjoyed them. Those are three competitions that are not normally discussed, not nearly as much as, of course, the 1981 Mr. Olympia, which we will be discussing next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. All right, everybody, take care of yourself. Have some good workouts out there. Enjoy your new year and be careful of all the shit going around. We'll see you guys next week. Take care.